to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. To begin today, I have a couple of updates for you. If you're a regular listener, you know that I'm interested in tracking the relational shift that's happening now in all fields. In physiology and biology, it's being driven by a lot of recent discoveries that the physical world is far more dynamically interrelated than our modern systems of knowledge had assumed. I've mentioned the relational shift that's going on right now in microbiology, for instance. It's going on in all fields, and not just the sciences. That's what the book Relational Reality was about, and this show continues my exploration of it. But there's a massive shift going on right now off of the mechanistic model of how bacteria supposedly function and onto a relational model. Specifically, they've discovered that the effects of a bad bacteria can be blocked by the presence of a good bacteria. Yes, the bacteria operate in relationship. Who knew? This means that it's no longer necessary to routinely carpet bomb your entire microbiota simply to get rid of one troublemaking kind of bacteria. It's a new day dawning in microbiology, that's for sure, and in medicine. And this doesn't mean you never take antibiotics, but a lot of doctors are still handing them out for simple bacterial infections. And let me point you in the direction of Chinese herbs. If you can connect with a really experienced practitioner of the Chinese medical system, many a time when I lived in San Francisco did I have bacterial infections in intestines or whatever, completely cleared through Chinese herbs. They're extremely effective, and they don't wreck the rest of your microbiota. So think about that as a possibility. Anyway, I mentioned a very good overview article of this big relational shift that's going on. That was in the New Yorker last fall, the October 22nd issue. And now I want to tell you about an article that came out last Sunday in the New York Times Magazine, May 19th, by Michael Pollan, entitled The Secret Life of Germs. This article is focused entirely on the fascinating ecological system of bacteria that inhabits your intestines. And they better, or you couldn't digest food. He brings the microbiology of interrelatedness to a very personal level of what a human being needs from the moment we're born to be a healthy, thriving organism. So check it out. It's online, New York Times website, The Secret Life of Germs. Second, to jump up here from the microscopic level to the international level, but the relational shift is happening everywhere. You might remember my interview last fall with Jerry Mander. He's a founder of the International Forum on Globalization. Well, they are sponsoring a big event on June 1st and 2nd, which you really might think about getting to if you live on the West Coast, especially anywhere near the San Francisco Bay Area. It's a two-day teach-in entitled Moana Nui, which means Great Ocean. And the subtitle is Peoples of the Pacific, Confronting Militarization, Resource Theft, Globalization, and America's, quote, Pacific Pivot, unquote. Here's the descriptive paragraph on their electronic flyer. As militarization and corporate globalization rapidly advance in the Pacific, we urgently need deep collaboration and dialogue with and among Pacific peoples. They are being directly confronted by the expansionist drives of the world's most dominant powers, the United States, China, Russia, as well as Indonesia and Japan, all seeking economic and political control of Pacific territories. Resource battles, giant trade agreements, and rapidly accelerating preparations for wars across the region are threatening the lands, the environment, rights, cultures and sovereignties of all Pacific nations and indigenous peoples. As the saying goes, when elephants battle, the ants are crushed. New resistance is required. So, you know, folks, Americans are generally so oblivious to the ways in which our foreign policy and corporate behavior are experienced on the ground level in other countries. This is a good opportunity to hear panels with 45 speakers from 20 Asian Pacific nations. After all, we ourselves are a Pacific Rim country. Let's connect. Here are some of the subjects of the panels. Indigenous rights, local sovereignty, and, quote, free, prior, and informed consent, unquote. And then another on militarization, the new Pacific pivot. And I trust you're aware that the Pacific pivot is President Obama's initiative to pull out of Afghanistan and Iraq and reallocate 60% of our overseas military spending, or maybe all our military spending, to build new bases in the Pacific and pave over lots of land and make lots of community disruption. And, yeah, the Pacific pivot. Mm-hmm. Here's what it looks like from the people who will be affected. Then there's a panel on Pacific resistance movements, and there's a panel on cross-Pacific collaborations, a new Pacific monitoring authority, and other proposals. And then one on battles for Pacific domination, U.S., China, Russia, Indonesia, Japan versus the Pacific peoples. So this new Trans-Pacific partnership is one of the things they'll be discussing. It's another son of WTO, like NAFTA. It's a regional trade agreement that will allow American and other transnational corporations to go into these Pacific Island countries and just take whatever resources they want, set up plants that use how much ever water they want. They don't even have to tell the national governments, just as they've done in India. So that's being touted in Washington as this great triumphal breakthrough, but the people on the other side see it quite differently. So for more information about this event on June 1st and 2nd, please go to their website for the International Forum on Globalization, which is simply ifg.org. If you can't make it to the event, check the IFG website later on for the book that will surely come out of this gathering. Now, staying on the international level with our thinking about interrelatedness today, my guest is Ashoka Bandaragi. She's the author of a new book, Sustainability and Well-Being, as well as other books, The Separatist Conflict in Sri Lanka, and the subtitle is Terrorism, Ethnicity, and Political Economy, and another book, Women, Population, and Global Crisis, and another, Colonialism in Sri Lanka. She's also written many articles in the fields of social philosophy and consciousness, environmental sustainability, human well-being and health, global political economy, ethnicity, gender, population, and social movements in South Asia. She holds a PhD and has taught at Brandeis University, Mount Holyoke College, Georgetown University, American University, and other institutions here and abroad. She works with several activist organizations, including Interfaith Moral Action on the Climate, and she writes for The Huffington Post. Ashoka Bandaragi, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'd like to begin with your telling the listeners about your background, your previous books, and then how you came to write Sustainability and Well-Being. In other words, what has been the progression of your thinking over the years and your activism? But first, I must ask what it's been like to go through life with the great name Ashoka. And for those who are listening who don't know, let me explain here that Ashoka is a very famous name in the Theravada Buddhist cultures of South Asia. He was Emperor Ashoka, head of the Maurya dynasty, which ruled almost all of the Indian subcontinent from 269 BCE to 232 BCE. He started out as a typically ambitious young ruler, but at some point after the Battle of Kalinga, which he won, he reflected on the scores of thousands of lives that had been lost for the sake of conquest. And he then became a Buddhist. And he dedicated himself to social programs for the people and made possible their learning the meditation practice taught by the Buddha, which is called Vipassana, meaning clear insight or insight meditation or mindfulness meditation. I know a lot of you listening have learned mindfulness meditation as it's been lifted out of the Buddhist setting. You've learned it in therapeutic and business and educational settings, but this is where the real thing began and is still situated. So Emperor Ashoka then built many rest houses for people who were traveling to these pilgrimage sites of Buddhism, and he sent out missionaries to distant lands to spread the message of the Buddha, the message of Dhamma, or Dharma, the way out of mental suffering. And he had 33 beautifully carved, large, tall pillars built across present-day India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. And these are inscribed with what's been named the Edicts of Ashoka, which are passages telling about his how he converted to Buddhism, why his the appeal of Dhamma, his efforts to spread Buddhism, or the teachings of the Buddha on some of the pillars, or Ashoka's social welfare programs and his animal protection programs. So he's known as Ashoka the Great. So Ashoka the Guest, what's it like to be wrapped in his mantle in the 20th and 21st centuries?
Well, I don't really think about it too much, except that I would say that his example is very relevant to the United States at this point in history, in terms of the possibility of transformation from a militaristic and domineering power to show the path to the kind of transformation that is needed in the world at this time. And it is also important to recognize that a lot of the new thinking on the kind of relational shift that you're talking about, you know, the psychosocial transformation that I also discussed in my book, at the center of that is the United States. So there is this contradiction at the, on the one hand, the U.S. is the superpower, the militaristic power, but at the same time, a lot of the alternatives and the direction for a new future also lies here. And I think it's a question of that becoming stronger than the domineering aspects. So in that sense, you know, Ashoka's example is extremely relevant to today. And, you know, I guess it's nice to, you know, be linked to that legacy in some form or the other.
Well, that must be what your parents had in mind when they looked down at their beautiful baby girl and said, ah, Emperor Ashoka, Ashoka the Great.
But it's also interesting that Ashoka is a male name, and most of people who have the name in the South Asian subcontinent happen to be male.
Yeah.
And so I'm also a female, you know, with this male name. But I think the importance is the meaning of the name. Ashoka means free from anxieties, free from dukkha. So there is a sort of a fundamental meaning there, you know, that is appropriate globally.
Okay, so how about your progression through these areas you've addressed in your career and activism?
Yes, you know, I started out with more of a sort of a political economy focus, trying to understand the North-South relationship, and my earlier work, like colonialism in Sri Lanka, looked at that, and I wanted to understand that historically, so I did a lot of historical research. Then from the beginning, I was also interested in the gender dimension, you know, which was neglected in the earlier academic perspectives.
Right.
So that came into play. But I also began to see the limitations of a purely academic perspective, that it is not possible to really find the understanding or the solutions from simply academic, intellectual perspective. So I've also been a student and practitioner of Vipassana meditation and Hatha yoga for a very long time. And it is the sort of synthesis of these different aspects that led to the writing of Sustainability and Well-being, which is also my own sort of response and attempt to contribute to the global discourse on what's really happening in the world, and how we can address that, because I think we need to hear from more voices and alternative perspectives from around the world. And in fact, even the discourse on what needs to be changed is really monopolized by a few institutions and individuals in the West. So I'm bringing in a perspective, you know, that is informed by Buddhism and the middle path, but I think that it's really a universalist perspective which calls for moving away from extremism to a more balanced approach to understanding ecological balance, social balance, and also the inner balance that we need to develop more as individuals, given that the world is moving at such a fast pace and becoming more and more mechanistic and market-oriented, that we are beginning to forget the other dimensions of reality. And so the discourse, I think, is really important, rather than accepting this dominant trajectory as a given and as inevitable.
Mm-hmm. I just want to back up a minute when you were talking about the post-colonial situation. In the country you're from, in Sri Lanka, what was the major dynamic after the colonial period? I mean, I think during the colonial period, the whole island was, what, pretty much given over to tea plantations, is that right? And then what happened mm-hmm. to those?
Yeah, you know, in my earlier book, The Separatist Conflict in Sri Lanka, I deal with this issue at great length, and what has been sort of conceived as an ethno-religious conflict is actually much more complex than that, and that I look at the local, regional, particularly the South Asian, South Indian context and the global context, and also sort of looking at the inequalities, not just in terms of ethnic and religious groups, but across social classes, that people who come from the marginalized social classes, regardless of their ethnicity, have been looking for and wanting the same kinds of access to education, employment, so on and so forth. But it gets interpreted as ethnic struggles and ethnic conflicts, overlooking sort of the commonalities across ethnic divides. So I uh-huh. get into, you know, a detailed discussion of that in that book, you know, sort of looking at continuing marginalization of populations and countries as a whole, especially in the southern hemisphere, which has led to the emergence of many of these so-called ethno-religious conflicts.
Mm-hmm. I had followed for many years the movement Sarvodaya or Sarvodaya mm-hmm. in Sri Lanka.
Yes.
And mostly through Joanna Macy's initial book, and then mm-hmm. Hearing Ariaratne when he came to the United States on some lecture tours, which was extremely interesting because it mm-hmm. was a grassroots movement that, as you were doing in this book, incorporated familiar elements of the Buddhist teaching. For instance, in the Buddhist culture, it's considered positive to give alms to the monks or food mm-hmm. who come begging door to door in this certain orders. And he said, you know, just as you give dana, alms or food, it's the same, you know, beneficial act for yourself to give your labor in community projects to build a road or clean out the canal. Or so I thought that was so smart. And I wonder, first, what happened to it during the Civil War? And secondly, what do you think of that movement?
Well, you know, I've had a lot of experience with the movement. I worked as an international consultant to the Sarvodaya's women's movement for quite a long time.
Uh-huh.
So I have first-hand experience working with them, particularly on income generation projects for women and organic agricultural projects. So they've taken a leadership in terms of introducing solar technology and alternatives to chemical pesticides. So that work has continued, you know, even during the course of the armed conflict. And there's a lot of lessons to be learned from that movement and also the application of the philosophy to social change. And that's also, you know, something that I discuss in the book, because change doesn't mean doing away with any kind of a new technology or growth. It's about appropriate technology, you know, alternatives to fossil fuel, alternatives to chemical pesticides. And, you know, there are many efforts, you know, in that direction. And similarly, people who are poor need to consume more. So I think when we are talking about, what we are talking about is balance. There's overconsumption on the one hand, particularly in the northern industrialized countries, and there is underconsumption on the part of the absolutely poor. So the issue of inequality really needs to be addressed, even with regard to climate change. I mean, for example, you know, 80% of the greenhouse gas emissions is attributed to the northern industrialized countries. And so that there needs to be greater responsibility towards that on the part of the North in terms of, you know, cutting back on meat consumption, for example. Mm-hmm. Likewise, you know, the poorest of the poor, you know, they need to have access to food and clean water, so on and so forth. So in terms of addressing sustainability and well-being, we also need to address the issue of inequality, because not every individual is responsible for the climate crisis or the destruction of ecosystems in exactly the same way. So that's what I try to do in this book, is to sort of bring an integrated perspective to understanding sustainability and well-being, that they are not two separate issues, that they need to be approached in terms of sort of the underlying social and economic issues and a broader perspective.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I just want to back up. I'm so curious. What happened to all those tea plantations? Did any become cooperatively owned, or were they taken over the ownership by elites, local elites, or was there foreign ownership that swooped in, or what happened to them after the colonial period?
Yes. I mean, a lot of different things have happened. I mean, at one time, they were nationalized by the state, you know, when there was a sort of spate of nationalizations and, you know, attempts to own them locally, but that did not necessarily work out well. That kind of backfired because of, you know, bureaucratic inefficiencies, so on and so forth. And it has sort of been, the plantations have been privatized. Tea export continues to be important, but it is no longer the sort of the main foreign exchange earner for the country. Yes, you know, the tea plantations are there and they are important, but that's also one of the problems in terms of local self-sufficiency and production of food rather than exports. You know, and I discussed this actually in my first book, Colonialism in Sri Lanka, how, you know, the economy was really transformed towards export production rather than local food production.
Right.
And how sort of monocultural practices were introduced that were harmful for local self-sufficiency as well as the environment. So some of the roots of current problems do in fact lie in the plantation economy that was introduced by the British.
Right. And it's interesting that even after independence, so many countries were still thinking in that modern way of the export model. And all we have to do is nationalize and you know, keep exporting to get currency coming in instead of restoring some land to the people so there's community security in food supply. But that was not in the modern way economists were trained then. So, okay, well, let's move into your book then. And I like the linking of sustainability and well-being. It seemed to me that throughout it was, as you mentioned a bit ago, the same wavelength I'm on with what I call eco-social. We need eco-social solutions to these big problems that bring both together in the analysis and the vision of what we want to build. So where do you start there? Can you give your overview in that area?
Yes, I mean, I start, especially in the introduction, with three different conceptual approaches to looking at this interconnection. And the sort of dominant perspective, which tries to incorporate society and environment within a larger sort of mechanistic and market reality, sort of using or approaching humanity and nature as resources to be used for economic production and technological expansion. And that seems to be the direction in which we are going, and that is seen more and more as a sort of the mark of success, when in fact, you know, that is also creating a collapse of the environment ecosystems as well as cultures and human communities. And I contrast that with the ecological perspective, where the, you know, we as human beings and the economy, which is just a sub-sector of society, are placed within this broader reality, the larger reality of the environment, and that we have to sort of respect and uphold ecological integrity, that, and that leads to the necessity for partnership ethic towards each other and the environment. And then I also posit the what is called the conventional or liberal approach, which is what is pursued by institutions like the United Nations, where the environment, society, and economy are seen as equivalent sectors. They refer to is that as the three pillars.
Yeah, separate, and equivalent is, and separate.
Yes, and that is a step forward from the dominant paradigm where you do recognize that the environment sustainability and social survival are important, but it's still not seen, they're seen as sort of equivalent rather than sort of subsectors within the broader environmental context. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I explain these and then sort of go on to look at the level of environmental collapse, you know, not just in terms of the climate crisis, but biodiversity loss and chemical pollution, and the human toll this takes, you know, in terms of
massive numbers. Before you move into that, that's a good stopping point. We have to pause here for the break. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Ashoka Bandaragi. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Ashoka Bandaragi. And her new book is Sustainability and Well-Being. So, Ashoka, is this, I know it's available, must be available on the publisher's website, Palgrave Macmillan. This is an e-book, nice short e-book, folks, won't take you too long, very informative. Is it also available on Amazon?
Yes, it is.
Uh-huh, okay. So let's get back to, you were talking about ecological destruction, and then I'd like to move into hearing about your middle path vision for eco-social solutions. But often we're not aware enough over here about the nature of the ecological destruction that the transnationals and the whole industrialization model has wrought on so many countries in the South. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, in terms of the, you know, interconnectedness between the environmental destruction and social destruction, one clear-cut example of that is environmental refugees, you know, because
right.
of the catastrophic climate change, you have environmental refugees, people who are getting displaced because of rising sea levels and floods and droughts and so on and so forth across the world. Entire island states like the Maldives, you know, are threatened to go underwater. And right now, the estimate is that there are some 11 million environmental refugees, but there will be many more in the years to come.
That's
so
right.
there is the sort of direct impact of climate change, and oftentimes these are among the poorest of the poor populations that are most affected by this. Then there are also the extinction not just of plants and species, but entire human groups, particularly the indigenous groups, like, for example, the Jarawas, who are among the last of the indigenous groups in the Andaman Islands off the coast of India, who are being wiped out because of development, like building of roads across their lands. And these are groups, you know, that have existed for thousands and thousands of years. And along with their extinction, there's also the extinction of their languages
mm-hmm.
and cultures. Then there's also the decimation of agricultural populations because of massive use of pesticides. I've been studying the case of chronic kidney disease in Sri Lanka among farming communities in certain regions, and even the WHO has now come out with reports claiming that this chronic kidney disease is attributable to massive use of agrochemicals.
Mm-hmm.
And same kinds of things are happening among agricultural communities in Central America and parts of India. So there are different types of destruction and extinction that is taking place. And the thing is that these are not sort of separate from our lives in the northern industrialized countries, because if we are talking about pesticides, you know, pesticides in food that can be exported, you know,
that's right.
that comes back to the north,
yeah.
And the pollution that comes through the ecosystem. So it's all very much interconnected. And of course, some of these pesticides have been banned in the in countries like the United States, but they're still dumped in
Yeah, I was just thinking about of why the kidney diseases would be so much higher among agricultural workers in the South. It's because the corporations, the agrochemical corporations, export toxic pesticides and herbicides that cannot be sold here anymore.
Right, right. And you know, this applies to so many other arenas, like environmental standards and working conditions in factories which produce export of garments, as we've seen in the horrendous case of Bangladesh. And So there is, you know, this sort of destruction where the brunt of it is borne by the poorest of the poor, particularly in the southern countries. But, you know, we are all sort of implicated and affected by these developments in different degrees.
Yeah. Well, let's move into your vision here of a middle path guideline. This is the Buddha's idea, right language, and we've added right livelihood. Of course, he meant right actions. That would have been right livelihood would have been included under right actions, right speech, right thoughts. So what does this right eco-social solution look like to you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't get into the details of the Buddhist path or the Buddhist philosophy that deeply, but sort of presenting the middle path as a more balanced alternative to the extremes that are dominant in the world today, because the mechanistic market approach is extremist because it does not incorporate ethical, ecological, social criteria into decision making. So it goes in extremist, it develops in extremist ways, sort of destroying ecosystems, destroying societies, alienating people from each other, fragmenting the natural sort of integration of life and so on and so forth. And then the reaction to that model often takes the form of another type of extremism, which is ethno-religious fundamentalism. So what is a sort of a balanced middle? And this is not necessarily peculiar to Buddhism. I think you do find, you know, more balanced approaches from other religious traditions as well. But I found that particularly in terms of the economy, you know, which is so central, the transformation of the economy is so central to addressing the crisis facing the world, that the middle path is really helpful, both in terms of addressing production and consumption. From overconsumption on the one hand to underconsumption on the other, you know, how do we find a more balanced path, which is not to say that, you know, in terms of production and consumption that we have to go back to sort of a pre-modern, static, hunter-gatherer existence. Because, you know, how do we find the balance? How do we create the limits and the regulation? And it is not even saying necessarily that it is anti-capitalist. I think it is more questioning what type of capitalism. I think the problem is not entrepreneurship. We do need more entrepreneurship, more jobs for people, because that is really one of the central issues in the world today, that there aren't enough jobs, sources of livelihood for people, because, you know, the economy is driven by technology, and, you know, there's got to be more sources of livelihood for people. So it's a question of I think the problem is the concentration, the monopolistic kind of capitalist growth, the transnational corporate dominance in every sector of production and distribution. That does not allow for more alternatives and diversity of
I mean, I think the two big problems you would have to overcome with this attractive model of a middle path, the social development, eco-social, you know, would be this open-ended growth model. You have to grow every year. You can't make the same percentage of profits you made last year. You have to always be getting bigger and bigger and bigger, bigger market share, because someone's nipping at your heels. You'd have to somehow be able to address that. And secondly, as you say, in terms of shaping a different kind of capitalism, there are already organizations and movements over here, as I'm sure you're aware, that are getting corporations and community-based businesses, for sure, to voluntarily change that attitude that an incorporated business owes nothing to the community, owes nothing to, you know, the people who provided all the public sewer lines and water lines and everything they're benefiting from, and the public education that makes people able to buy their software or whatever. So to shift that, you know, and say a certain part of our profits are going to go back to the community, mm-hmm. in ways that, as you know, you say, perhaps would further entrepreneurship, education, community structures. So that has started, although on a small scale. But when I think back to what you said in the beginning, it was very interesting that Ashoka's situation is parallel to our situation, because he started out as a big militarist, and then he had this, you know, conversion experience, and completely changed the course of his life and his reign. But everything was in place economically. I mean, since it was an empire, I suppose all the different territories were sending tribute all the time. That didn't change. For us to move off the militarism and this open-ended growth model means we really, you know, have to address and somehow make that change happen in those corridors of power, which are now just running roughshod over the planet.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, the issue of the political will is so important. And unfortunately, it's not just the United States, but other countries are pursuing the same model of competitive growth, you know, overlooking the environmental and social consequences, you know, countries like China and India. So there's got to be a global shift. But I think in that shift, the United States can play a very important role, particularly citizen organizations and civil society and individuals, in terms of you know, moving in that ecological and socially balanced direction, because if more and more countries are sort of trying to compete within this sort of failed model, you know, there is really not much hope for the world at large.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of the discussions and experiments and so on that are taking place in the United States, you know, need to be expanded and also to be known globally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd like to move into a very charged area with this model of the middle path, the middle way, and that is population and condition of the ecosystems around the world. So you wrote a book a while ago, Women, Population, and Global Crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to know what your middle way approach would be. I find it maddening that it took decades for the research that population sort of gets under control when women are given small-scale economic opportunities, as you say, entrepreneurship, mm-hmm. educational opportunities, and health care for them and their children. When you put those three things in place, that's how you do it. And that was just on the margins for so long, and finally you hear it mentioned now in mainstream work. But anyway, with a middle path vision, how do you see this issue of population and ecology today?
Yeah, I mean, what is clear is that global fertility levels are coming down, you know, even faster than was expected.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of the population expansion...
Except in Africa, in some African countries.
Except in sub-Saharan African countries.
Yeah.
But overall, fertility is coming down, but the population, the actual numbers are still increasing because of what they refer to as population momentum, because of the existence of, you know, large numbers in childbearing age. So yes, you know, you're right that it's about women's choice and access to education and opportunities. You know, that's rather than sort of a top-down model where, you know, there is sort of forced sterilization or experimental contraceptives being used on women, and that's not the way to go. So that
right.
again, the middle path is one of sort of compassion and tolerance and partnership.
Yeah.
But the other aspect of this is population becomes problematic also because of lack of job opportunities.
Right. That is the global crisis.
That is the global crisis, and that's also because...
Along with global warming. I don't want to say the global crisis. It is a global crisis.
It's a massive crisis, and also because now they're saying that by 2030 or something, and this may be an exaggeration, that there will be more robots in the workforce than human beings. But even if that is an exaggeration, still that is the direction in which we are moving, because, you know, that may be profitable to... certain corporations and so on, but that leaves, that marginalizes people, that makes people a surplus population.
Yeah,
so
it's not only robots, you're right, but just putting so many kinds of making of things, production, onto the internet has wiped out tons of jobs. You know, book printers, bookmakers, sales clerks, just a huge amount of jobs have disappeared because of moving everything onto the internet.
Yeah,
that's another
it's a technological
factor.
Development, yeah. And then not counting all the sort of emotional, psychological, social dimensions. You know, this is just in terms of livelihood, you know. Yes.
Yeah. So, if you were at one of those major institutions now, with all these big forces happening and the Trans-Pacific Partnership probably going to happen, and I mean, what would you do to change the course of this, you know, big system that just keeps rolling over people?
I think that one thing is to keep the dialogue alive. So the work that you're doing and many of us are doing is important because it's not always easy for us to get access to the mainstream media or the mainstream institutions. But then what happens is, you know, it leads to a kind of monopoly of ideas and perspectives, and that should not be allowed, because then we do really need the freedom. We lose our freedom. And it is not that we have ready-made answers or magic wands, but we have to have more discussion and dialogue, because the kind of trajectory that we are on is not a God-given, so to speak. You know, it is human-created.
Created, definitely.
We have the wisdom to try to make certain changes. It's not talking about utopia or paradise, but to make the planet sustainable and a better place to live so that there is a future for the generations to come. So I think this work of education and discussion is really very important, and I do want to thank you not just for the radio show you're doing, but all the work you've been doing for decades.
We have just a couple minutes, but I just want to take this opportunity to learn more. In addition to the big vision you've laid out, moving back to Sri Lanka, what's the situation right now, just in about a minute and a half, of after the war? War makes such a terrible aftermath. There's so much upheaval and loss and mourning and things broken apart. What is the situation now after the conflict?
Yeah, it is very complex. You know, I mean, the armed conflict is over, and there is a sense of incredible relief on the part of everyone that, you know, they can step out and there are no bombs going off and suicide bombers, you know, all over the place. So that is a huge relief for the country at large. And, you know, there has been sort of various efforts in terms of social development, economic development, so on and so forth. But the armed conflict is over, but the political conflict continues because there are still vested interests, small groups of people who want to sort of carry on the struggle for secessionism to create a separate state.
Uh-huh.
And that requires ethnic polarization. So you have to keep cultivating the polarization even even when the country is sort of really a very multicultural place and people live side by side, they work together, there's a lot of interchange, but, you know, certain groups of people feel that they have to feed the polarization in order to, you know, continue their efforts, which is not to say that there aren't changes that need to be made and reconciliation and attempts to bridge ethnic, religious, social class divides. But I hope that the forces for unity and peace prevail over the forces of disunity and violence.
Oh, well, that's a perfect note to end on. So that's all the time we have. And Ashoka Bandaragi, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, let's move over to the Arts Corner now. Our poem this week, well, it's May. So we'll hear a bit of The May Magnificat by Gerard Manley Hopkins from the 1870s in England. And here it is. Flesh and fleece, fur and feather, grass and green world, all together, star-eyed, strawberry-breasted throstle above her nested cluster of bugle-blue eggs thin, forms and warms the life within, and bird and blossom swell in sod or sheath or shell. All things rising, all things sizing, Mary sees, sympathizing with that world of good, nature's motherhood. For our song, well, I happened to hear a performance, it was on TV, of Jerry Butler singing a song he first recorded over 50 years ago, in 1958. The song is For Your Precious Love, and he still sounds good. Unfortunately, our precious love for our beautiful blue-green garden planet hasn't come to much in terms of protecting and defending it effectively. Well, there are a lot of actions coming up this summer demanding a real response to the climate crisis, so do jump in. I'll be telling you about them in the weeks to come. Here's For Your Precious Love.
Wanting you, I'm lonely and
That was Jerry Butler singing For Your Precious Love. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who my guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespratnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Next week, my co-host, Eleanor LeCain, will be here with two guests, Van Jones, founding president of Rebuild the Dream, and Michael Cantor, an activist for community-based businesses and co-owner of Cambridge Naturals. I'll be back 2 weeks from today with my guest, Richard Falk. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlene Spratnak with All Together Now. Now that we know it, let's really show.